Republicans to wake up.
It's
the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com.
And who else could that be but The Who? Mr. Townsend's fantastic band putting punch into one of Pete's numbers called I'm Free.
I'm free. I'm free.
That's the Top of the Pops version of The Who's I'm Free. And I open the podcast today with that song in honor of Shocker Ammer, the last British resident held at Guantanamo. And on September 25th, the Obama administration announced that he has been cleared for release to Great Britain, and with notification to Congress, it should occur before the end of October. In today's conversation, we catch up with Andy Worthington, the British journalist who has been covering Guantanamo for more than 10 years. He wrote the Guantanamo Files and continues to blog regularly at andyworthington.co.uk. And Andy and colleagues led the campaign in Britain to stand with Shocker Ammer, and they used a huge inflatable doll with a cartoon character of Shocker Ammer on it. It was kind of their gimmick to get media attention, and it worked. We'll hear about what led to the decision to release Shocker Ammer, the current status at Guantanamo, President Obama's determination to close it, and whether he will actually succeed. That's all ahead in our conversation with Andy Worthington. And before we start, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Judy Holloway, Deborah Kennedy, Bob Donjakour, and Joe Clarici. They're all monthly subscribers, and I invite you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, our newly designed website. You click on the button that says Menu, and then become a subscriber, and you can take it from there. I appreciate your support, and I'm grateful that you listen. Andy Worthington is a man of many talents. He's a journalist, an author, a filmmaker, an accomplished photographer. And now, as one of the four fathers, we know that he's a singer-songwriter. Here's a tune he wrote called Song for Shocker Ammer.
This is a song for Shocker Ammer, the last British man in Guantanamo. Stuck in his cell alone, U.S. says it wants to let him go.
Well, the U.S. has finally said they're going to let Shocker Ammer go. Clock is ticking from 25th of September, a 30-day notification to Congress. And so by all accounts, by Halloween, if that's an important date to you, Shocker Ammer should be repatriated to Britain and reunited with his family, including his youngest child, who was born at about the time he was sent to Guantanamo. Andy Worthington is the guy I was praising there just a moment ago. And Andy, you and your colleagues who have led the campaign for Shocker Ammer deserve a victory lap. You and I have talked about Guantanamo for many years now, and it's rare that we have a moment of a kind of positive nature. So congratulations to you and all the people in Britain and, in fact, around the world who led the campaign to win freedom for Shocker Ammer.
Well, thank you, Peter. Yes, and you know, and you're right. It's unfortunately rare, I think, in the world of issues of human rights and injustices that we get victories like this. And it's obviously it is the work of a huge number of people. I mean, you know, I've been involved for many years in supporting an organization called the Save Shaka Armor Campaign, who were working for years to try and get Shaka Armor out, and eventually hit on this notion that they would stand outside Parliament once a week wearing the orange jumpsuits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they put in a huge amount of work. They then started to attract the attention of MPs, and you know, and I would say that the most significant people who regularly supported the campaign were John McDonnell. So one of the firebrand left-wing Labour MPs, who miraculously is now the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, because his close friend, the other firebrand left-wing MP who has always been there resisting and just standing up for what's right, Jeremy Corbyn, mm-hmm. you know, became elected as the leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
So John, you know, John was always regularly coming across the road to support things. Caroline Lucas, who is our only Green MP, who's also somebody who's been very much behind this case. And then, of course, you know, something less than a year ago, Joanne McInnes, a campaigner that I met here, and I set up the We Stand With Shaka campaign,
mm-hmm.
With a giant inflatable figure of Shaka armor, and asked celebrities and MPs to stand with it. And it was just something that, you know, beforehand we weren't sure. Some people clearly thought that a large inflatable figure was something of a joke, but you know, you try out campaigning things and sometimes they have a resonance with people, and the giant inflatable figure of Shaka had a resonance with people, and the campaign became quite high profile, I think, and certainly, you know.
And whose idea was the inflatable Michelin Man figure?
Well, you know, it was my idea. What happened is that it was at a meeting for Shaka Armour. Basically, John McDonnell would call a meeting with the Save Shaka Armour campaign about every 6 months in Parliament, and I was speaking at this, and Joanne had come along for the first time, and I said, look, I think we need something that would get the media to pay attention. We need to have, like the elephant in the room, we need to have a giant inflatable figure of Shaka Armour that would rear up every time that David Cameron or the other senior Tories were somewhere. And of course, that, you know, it's quite impractical to you know, ambush senior government people with a 12-foot high figure of somebody. But the notion was there that that's what we should do with it. And Joe went, well, look, you know, I think I'm going to get this thing made. So, you know, so she did. And then came the process of trying to work out exactly what would be the best campaign, and finally hitting on this idea of getting people to stand with the figure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it came about, and I, you know, I'm very, very glad that it's been something that has such resonance, but particularly that, you know, the huge amount of work of so many people, and you know, the MPs came together. John McDonnell set up a little under a year ago, the same time we set up the We Stand With Shaka campaign. He set up the Shaka Armour parliamentary group to call for Shaka's release, and we had, you know, that developed cross-party support. So there have been, you know, significant Tory MPs working on that, as well as John and Jeremy Corbyn, lots of Labour people, and representatives of almost every political party that exists in the British Parliament.
And Andy, you certainly seem to have gotten traction with Prime Minister Cameron, because we do know that when he came to the White House for a state visit in January, he raised it with President Obama and was given some bland assurances that we're going to urgently look into this. And so your campaign really did become very broad-based and become almost a national interest, as opposed to, you know, a humanitarian drive or a human justice campaign that is often limited to the subset of people who are really passionate about it.
Yeah, and you know, and part of that, you know, Peter, is definitely that you know, it seems that particularly when our campaign arose, it was a time that the Daily Mail took an interest, and the Daily Mail is, you know, a right-leaning newspaper in the UK with a huge readership, and they got behind it, and they got behind it on the basis that many of the Tories who got behind this campaign did, which you know, and this isn't exclusive to them, but it was certainly something that I think came through. Which is that it may be that that Shaka Armour, as the Daily Mail put it, he may be a bad man. Now, you know, there are many reasons for doubting that that is true. But their issue was, it isn't about who he is, it's about how he's been treated. And how he's been treated is in defiance of what we accept the law should be. And therefore, it's extremely important for us to keep our notion of the law intact and bring this man back from, you know, from this terrible place. And, you know, I absolutely commend people for upholding those values, because I think that's what's so significant. And I think it also highlights the problem with the United States keeping a prison like Guantanamo open, is that, you know, President Obama, any significant American person who wants to defend America's allegiance to the rule of law, is going to hit a brick wall pretty swiftly when it comes to the fact that Guantanamo exists, where, you know, the law was sent to die in that place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's been really quite remarkable to see such support. And I suppose it's a real testament to the belief in the rule of law across, you know, so much of British society, actually. Yeah.
Well, and also this issue was raised to the international level, and I'll just give you one example, a snapshot. The Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei, who is now putting together an exhibit in Great Britain, I believe, last year he organized an exhibit at the Alcatraz Island Prison in San Francisco Bay.
Right.
And he had this most unusual and imaginative way of depicting over 100 political prisoners who at that time were locked up around the world. Included was Shocker and John Kiriakou, the American CIA agent who was in a U.S. prison at that time. And so what Ai Weiwei did was create depictions of all of these political prisoners, and then they were part of a huge tapestry made of Legos. And
right.
This was spread out over the floor of a huge warehouse space at Alcatraz. And it was so high impact to be in a prison setting and to see this art drawn from the personal experiences of Ai Weiwei, who was born in prison and has been imprisoned himself in China, and his awareness, despite the sharp handcuffs that the Chinese place on him and limit his access to contact with the outside world, that he was able to compile not only a list, but creative renderings of all of these political prisoners. And the final step was that Ai Weiwei created individual postcards for each one of these political prisoners. And the hundreds of thousands of people who came through the exhibit were given the opportunity to sign a postcard and write a little note. And the Art Institute paid the postage and mailed the postcards to the individual prisoners. Well, I'm eager, you know, after Shocker gets settled, to find out how he responded to the receipt of these postcards. But I did speak to John Kiriakou about it, and he was just floored. He had no idea these were coming, and one day at mail call, there were over 500 postcards.
Wow.
And just that expression, and the fact that it was embraced by so many strangers, who Kiriakou had no idea who they were or why they cared, made an indelible impression. And
well, you know,
go ahead.
I'm slightly ashamed to say that I didn't hear that Ai Weiwei had done this exhibition. And I also, you know, I wonder whether Shocker received them. I mean, it may be, Peter, that they didn't get through. We know that kind of obstruction still exists at Guantanamo, that things don't get through.
Yeah.
I have a letter writing campaign that I'm involved in encouraging people to do every 6 months, where I say, you know, please write to the prisoners. Just, you know, let them know they've not been forgotten. It's very important. But I do hear from people that their letters are returned to them without explanation. And of course, you know, I have no idea whether people don't hear about their letters, which also may not get through.
Right.
We know that some of them do, and I think that's the important thing, is that it should happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember, you know, Omar De Gaius, a former prisoner who I got to know well, showing myself a mountain of letters that he'd received during his years at Guantanamo,
mm-hmm.
and how significant it was to, you know, for the outside world to get this message through to them. But that's a very, you know, that's a great story. I mean, he's a very interesting artist.
Yeah. Well, I did attempt to actually send a picture of the Shocker Ammer depiction from Alcatraz, but as you and I discussed offline, there is sometimes a difficulty for you and me to communicate, and I'm not sure if somebody is intercepting our communications. But let me take you way back to Friday, September 25th.
Yes.
When early in the morning, I logged onto my computer and got the first word of the announcement that Shocker would be coming home in a month or so. How did you first learn about it, and what was your reaction, Andy?
Well, you know, I suppose it's confession time that I was doing one of these things that I do, which is essential for my sanity, Peter. And I was out on a bicycle in the afternoon. Where I am resolutely old school and 20th century about things, and I don't have any means of communication. I don't carry a mobile phone with me. So I was blithely oblivious to it taking place until I got home to find that that the phone had been ringing off the hook, that that Joanne McInnes, you know, my colleague in the We Stand With Shaka campaign, had been fielding requests from all kinds of media organizations. And in fact, you know, my wife had gone out, but my son was there, and he was looking at me in this weird, shiny-eyed manner. I couldn't tell what was going on. He said, "I've got something to tell you. I've got something to tell you." I was like, "What is it?" You know, and it's like, "Shaka's going to be freed." So, you know, I have to say, I was in shock initially, because, you know, you work for such a long time when you are campaigning against injustices. And, you know, as you know, I've been involved in this a lot longer than the slightly less than a year that We Stand With Shaka has been going on, longer even than my, you know, my involvement with the Save Shaka Ammer campaign. I mean, it will in spring, Peter, be 10 years since I first started working full time on Guantanamo, when I first started researching for my book, The Guantanamo Files. So, you know, and I was aware of Shaka's case then. So in some ways, you kind of think these injustices aren't going to end. I mean, Shaka, you know, there were rumors that Shaka would be released in 2007. There were rumors that he would be released in 2009. These were when the last British residents were freed. But it didn't happen.
Well, and there was a rumor this spring that I picked up and shared with you in May or so. And it looked like the wheels were turning at that time.
Well, I think by that point it was clear that, you know, he was going to be released. But, you know, when? So yeah, I mean, I was a bit numb, and then, you know, I was out at a launch of an art event that my wife was doing. It was an exhibition of hers. Was the launch night, and I was there, and people just kept coming up to me and saying, you know, well done, you know, and I ended up just you know, the happiness hit me then of like, wow, yeah, this is an achievement. This is something positive that has been achieved through campaigning, and you know, I was very pleased.
Well, and Andy, I think it's really instructional, because many of us look at these problems that we consider to be intractable, and we see governments that operate in secret and beyond the reach of the people they claim they serve and report to. And, you know, at the outset, this appeared to be a very daunting task, not quite impossible, but on the verge of impossible. And I'm glad that there are people like you who were undaunted and said, look, this is a massive injustice, and I cannot let it stand, and I must put whatever effort I can into every channel I can find until we come up with the formula that produces the desired outcome. And Andy,
right.
I won't go into great detail on this, but you know a little bit about me, and I'm very proud of the work that I've done in media in this country. But my greatest personal achievement was that I led a team of people that successfully won the release of a life prisoner from San Quentin, just down the road from me. It took 7 years. We got B.B. King and Carlos Santana to perform a benefit concert that raised the money that paid the lawyers and the investigators, that finally produced the evidence that permitted the parole board to release Dennis Jones. And at the beginning of that, it appeared impossible. The politics of the situation were out of control and kind of beyond the reach of average people. But a group of us just sat back and said, we can't allow this to stand. And so I really applaud you and your colleagues, because you didn't accept that this was impossible, and you actually did produce the result that you and many of the rest of us have wanted.
Well, I think you have to be prepared not to give up. I mean, and I must say, Peter, obviously, you know, we're talking here about the positive news, but you know, we wait for Shaka himself to be actually freed, because you know we have this 30-day period. So you know, it would be much more reassuring for us both to talk when he's actually a free man.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the other thing, you know, the campaign, the focus on Shaka Rama was partly because he was such a distinctive individual. He had such a voice. And it was also because of his connection with Britain, because he was a man given permanent leave to remain in the UK. So the British government absolutely had this responsibility to get him back. And yet the British government, the closest ally of the US in the war on terror, seemed unable to do so. So, you know, that was a good focus, obviously, and I'm British. So, you know, it was my home country. It was mm-hmm. something that could be done. But, of course, the bigger campaign, Peter, to close Guantanamo is one that's still ongoing, because, you know, there are still all these men held there who also need to be released if they're not going to be put on trial, because the injustice of Guantanamo remains the same essentially now as it was when it opened.
And in broad terms, we have about 112, 114 prisoners remaining. 50 plus of those are cleared for release.
Yeah, 53 of those guys have been approved for release. Now, 43 of those were approved for release. They were told in January 2010 that the high-level interagency Guantanamo Review Task Force that the president had established, President Obama's one of the first things he did, had said that, you know, the U.S. didn't want to hold them. They're still held. 10 other men have been approved for release in the last, getting on for 2 years now, by periodic review boards. So another high-level interagency process that was established to review the cases of all the men who hadn't previously been told that they were approved for release and who weren't facing trials. And what's important, you know, is for people to know that of the 114 men still held, just 10 of them are facing trials or have been tried.
Right.
There have over the years been suggestions that they might bump that number up, but actually all that's been happening over the years is that the very legal basis for trying people in the military commissions at Guantanamo has been unraveling. And that's a result of some very strong rulings, very unfavorable to the administration's point of view, handed down by the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the whole credibility of that has been undermined. But the essential problem remains that people are held at Guantanamo almost all without charge or trial.
Right.
And as the case of Shaka Rama, I think, so clearly demonstrates, how do they get out of there? There's no acceptable process for holding them. There's no end of hostilities at which they will be released as prisoners of war, because they were never held on that basis.
Well, let's go into that in a bit of detail here, because one of the things that we were told when Bush set up this offshore prison that he thought was outside the reach of the U.S. courts was that this was for the duration of the conflict. Now, the conflict has been fuzzily defined, but I took that to mean the U.S. combat operations in Afghanistan, because they were at least told to us as directly responsive to the attacks of 9/11 and the harboring of al-Qaeda individuals in Afghanistan. So we held a ceremony mid-December last year where we pretended that we have left Afghanistan, that is the end of combat operations. We have 9,800 troops remaining, and we're told they're not combat troops. So the definition has been met for the end of the hostilities that led to the incarceration of most of the people at Guantanamo. Yet,
right,
as prisoners have tested this in the courts so far, I haven't heard of a single one getting traction on the basis that they should be released because the conflict is over.
Yeah, well, no, they tried it, and then the court said no. You know, there will be an appeals process, but I don't think that that's going to get us anywhere either, Peter, because the problem is that the president has repeatedly said that the combat is over, but other people have said that that's not the case. And, you know, as with other things, it turns out that the president ultimately doesn't have the final say in this and ends up being overridden. It's wrong, surely, that men who have been detained longer than the duration of both the world wars put together are still not able to say or able to have their lawyers litigate successfully on their behalf over the question of, you know, how do we ever get to a point where we're going to hear that combat operations are over, that the war is over, that these people will be sent home, as has happened at the end of every other war.
Mm-hmm.
And the impression that we must end up getting, unfortunately, Peter, is that, as long as there is still some American presence on the ground in Afghanistan of somebody wearing a military uniform, then someone is going to argue that it's not over and that these men can't go home. It's one of those lingering injustices of the whole setup of imprisoning people without any due process. And it's always important to remember that the men were held at Guantanamo for 2.5 years before they had any rights whatsoever. They had no rights as human beings. There was not a damn thing that they could do to argue against the people who were holding them or to appeal to any outside body about their treatment that was recognized. The only people who managed to do anything under the radar were the International Committee of the Red Cross, who were allowed to meet all but a handful of the prisoners who were hidden from them and who, you know, we know from things that have been made public over the years, advocated very strongly for the rights of these men to, you know, be treated as human beings. But it really wasn't until the Supreme Court in June 2004, nearly 2.5 years after Guantanamo opened, said to the government, you know, you have to have some way of letting these men challenge their detention if, as many of them say, they were seized by mistake, that whole process began. And, you know, that was the one that finally allowed lawyers into the prison. And when we look back on the history, we will also remember that this was the point at which the most obvious torture that was taking place there, in fact, you might say a systematic torture program, had to be brought to an end, because suddenly outsiders, lawyers, were being allowed into the prison, mm-hmm. and they were unable to get away with that anymore.
Yeah,
you know, it's funny now, isn't it? It kind of sounds like ancient history, and I hope one day we're talking about it as history, Peter. But you know, the sad truth is that the place is still open. The wretched place is still open.
Yeah.
President Obama has had his hands tied in many ways, but he is the president of the United States. And every day that Guantanamo remains open, any notion that any American, yourself included, can look in the mirror and say, at least we uphold the rule of law, is shot.
Yeah.
You know, because, and that's really the great problem with Guantanamo. The reason that I'm required to stick with this story until it's over is that when a country of the stature of the United States says to the rest of the world, we're holding people indefinitely without charge or trial, there isn't any excuse that they can then add to that that makes it acceptable. This is the kind of thing that dictatorships do. And it's as simple as that. And until we can get back to a position where the United States understands that and implements that, then frankly, Peter, you know, we all should have reasons to worry that, you know, first they came after the Muslims, and now, you know, who's mm-hmm. going to be the next group of people that they came after?
Well, and Andy, the widespread denial in the United States, and I'm using that in the 12-step term, most Americans are in denial about the real legacy of Guantanamo and what it means in terms of history and what it means in terms of a legacy that is going to cause people to rebel against the United States, take up arms against the United States. And most people are comfortable in their ignorance. And I know many people. I have a brother, for example, who will not talk to me about this stuff. He's just convinced that anybody who went to Guantanamo is one of the most evil people on the planet, and that that they're entitled to nothing in terms of rights or process. And I think that is a view that is shared by far too many Americans. And
well,
it's what the people like, the right-wing Republicans and many Democrats who are complicit in this play along with. which is this sense that moving them to a supermax prison in the United States, and the phrase that's used is, you know, we cannot allow these people on American soil. Well, I mean, first of all, their detention is inappropriate and illegal. But if we just gloss over that and say, okay, if you're going to hold these people, what difference does it make if they're on the tip of Cuba or in a supermax prison facility in the United States? But it's just playing to these xenophobic instincts that have been quite aroused in American culture over the last few years. And Donald Trump is contributing to it even as we speak.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think the Guantanamoization of everyday politics is something that Trump seems to be doing every day, saying things that are patently absurd, that are dangerous. It's very sad to hear about, you know, about the normalization of indefinite detention without charge or trial after 9/11 that you're talking about in terms of one of your relatives, in terms of, I know, all manner of people who, you know, who have not been able to get or understand any of the things that any of us have been trying to say and do for all of these years about how, no, that is fundamentally wrong. If you are going to take that ultimate step of removing somebody from their liberty, there has to be a process to it. You have to be able to demonstrate that you're doing that in a way that's objectively fair. And it's shocking that people have accepted, no, I will allow my leaders to tell me I am keeping you safe as though I am some kind of small and frightened child, and you are some kind of omnipotent father figure who can make no mistakes. It's just wrong. I mean, what were the founding fathers of the United States doing if they weren't paying attention to the rule of law? Seems to me that it's very much built into your Constitution and your Bill of Rights, things that are essential, without which, where are we heading to? You know, and... Well, you know, I mean,
it's a mind bender. It really is. Andy, let's talk a little bit about the process that ultimately has put in motion the release of Shocker Ammer. We know that Chuck Hagel, the previous Secretary of Defense, was sacked in part for his reluctance or recalcitrance in approving releases. Congress gave him that authority as it tied the hands of the president in releasing people from Gitmo. And then Ashton Carter took the job, and he has been as slow as Hagel was, and in particular on the Ammer case, he seemed to really drag his feet. What have you been able to find out about the internal process, and what was it that pushed Ashton Carter over the edge or gave him the kind of assurances he needed to approve the release of Shocker Ammer?
Well, I suppose what I would say, Peter, is that actually, you know, I don't think Chuck Hagel did that bad a job. Actually, dozens of prisoners were approved for release by him. After you know, there was a major stumbling block that the president had to overcome, which came in May 2013. Huge hunger strike by the prisoners. Lots of international criticism of President Obama, which he wasn't used to on Guantanamo, and he resolved to take steps to try and increase the release of prisoners because, you know, again, it seems like ancient history now, but for nearly 3 years before that, only five people had been released from Guantanamo in a nearly 3 year period because of the impositions on the president by Congress, all these hoops that they had to jump through, which, you know, essentially President Obama was unwilling to spend political capital overcoming that. There is a waiver in the legislation which allows him to free people without consulting Congress if he decides to do that, and he's not doing that. He's not choosing that fight. So, you know, what happened after the hunger strike was that obviously more pressure was then put on the Office of the Defense Secretary to work out how to press ahead with the certifications for the release of prisoners, which the Defense Secretary has to make. You know, we're dealing with a large number of prisoners who can't be sent to their home countries. There is an absolute blanket prohibition across the whole of the U.S. political establishment on releasing any Yemeni back to his home country because of the deterioration in the security situation in Yemen.
And there's still at least 40 Yemenis at Guantanamo,
And I mean, it's terrible. I mean, at the moment, Peter, I have to say, you know, the place is being blown to hell by the Saudis and their allies. And, you know, and clearly it's unsafe to send anybody back there. But the notion that has been accepted that it wasn't possible to return anyone to that country because there is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda operating in it has always been disgraceful. But anyway, you know, we've had all of these things that make things, you know, more difficult for the releases to take place. But Chuck Hagel had, you know, approved the release of dozens of prisoners. Things were moving again. The administration obviously thought he wasn't moving quickly enough. Ash Carter comes in and then doesn't do anything. And I think it's, you know, it's on the same basis that the obligation is rests on the shoulders of the Defense Secretary to sign authorizations for their release, to say to Congress, we have mitigated risks to the extent that it's possible, you know, we have security assurances, all of this, and that they feel that responsibility. I have to say, to be honest, I think that, you know, I think that they do. If somebody is to be released from Guantanamo and is to end up, you know, taking up arms in some manner, then the flak for that is going to come back on the administration, but it's personally going to come back on the guy who signed off on his release, which is the Defense Secretary. So with Shaka Armour, I think the other issue that has been highlighted with Shaka Armour is that the Defense Secretary is in some ways a figurehead in the Pentagon and not, you know, not pulling the operational strings. Because I think it's clear that behind the scenes, there have been people, you know, we've heard of General Dempsey, for example, in articles over recent months, as being somebody who, you know, appears to regard the release of prisoners as something that across the board could be quite problematical, and maybe was not interested in you know, approving Shaka Armour's release. And we have, and I have to say, we're looking at a Pentagon where we're looking at behind Ash Carter. Is it that he's not pushing to get these files onto his desk? Or is it that people, other people in the Defense Department are, you know, are sitting on files and trying to make sure that they don't go to him for approval? Mm-hmm. It all looks a little bit dysfunctional to me, but, you know, I imagine that that's quite often how power looks once you start mm-hmm. peering behind the scenes and seeing why things are happening and why things aren't happening. But, you know, it does lead us to this position where, you know, all of these men have been approved for release, as we were talking about. You know, nearly half the men still held are men that the US said it didn't want to hold and said that to them between 5 and 6 years ago. Now, every day that you hold somebody that you said you didn't want to hold, I find much more disgraceful even than just saying we're holding you without charge or trial. I think it's even worse and psychologically awful for these men to have been told you're going home and then not to be sent home.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we need, I don't know quite what we need, Peter. As we have discussed, most of these men are Yemenis. They won't send them home, so other countries need to be found. Now, what we've had in the last year is 10 men being sent to Oman, you know, which is next to Yemen, which is a place where, you know, it's a Muslim country. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not like uprooting people and sending them to countries that have no Muslim population whatsoever, where they don't speak Arabic. Some greater effort is required in the administration to find new homes for these people, because it remains imperative every day that people you said you were going to release are going to be released.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, Peter, then we deal with the other issue of Guantanamo, which is the rest of the people, very few of whom are going to be put on trial, and this slow process that's taking place of reviewing their cases, essentially to decide whether they still constitute a threat and need to be held.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to say that that process has been taking place slowly over the last couple of years. That what's been happening is that prisoners have been working with military representatives assigned to them and with their lawyers to come up with plans that they can say comprehensively, you know, if required, I apologize for my behavior in the past. I am aging in this place. I want only to be reunited with my family. I seek to get on with my life. You know, what can we do to put things in place so that you will be assured that I am no risk to you? And I think it's very important. You know, I think what keeps happening, Peter, is that middle-aged men who were young men and quite possibly firebrandish in their youth, you know, are ailing in Guantanamo, are not a threat to anybody, and are just now trying to find a way to go home. And of course, it returns to those issues that we've discussed, that if these men have been held in any legal manner from the beginning, they would be able comprehensively to say, you know, your combat is over, it's time for me to go, or they would have been put on trial and they would have been charged and convicted of something, in which case there would be a sentence. So everything always comes back to the problem of a prison that was essentially set up to hold people without rights, and that when they do get some kind of rights, they don't really mean very much. You know, the habeas legislation that they were supposed to have was torn apart by right-wing judges. They are, in some ways, as Ai Weiwei, you know, very astutely figured out in Shaka Armour's case, political prisoners.
So, Andy, I'm looking at the New York Times article written by Charlie Savage that reported on the decision to release Shaka Armour. And it does reference your campaign. It includes a reference to Prime Minister Cameron, Jeremy Corbyn, and various British celebrities like Roger Waters, Peter Gabriel, and Sting.
Yeah.
But then Savage goes on to repeat what Pentagon and political leaders have fed to him. And I want you to comment on this. Some American officials, unnamed, have portrayed him as a charismatic, manipulative, and potentially dangerous Islamist leader who had many links to Qaeda figures before his capture in Afghanistan in 2001, and who encouraged hunger strikes and maybe even suicides at the Guantanamo prison where he was taken in February 2002. Just comment on those assertions, because I believe that they are either based on information extracted by torturing other prisoners at Guantanamo, or American intelligence propaganda.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a problem. I mean, and you know, Charlie Savage was entitled to draw information from the previously classified military file on Shaka Armour that, like all the others, was released by WikiLeaks in 2011. That's where that comes from. He should have allowed somebody to tackle those allegations rather than just printing them in that manner, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been not at all difficult to pick up the phone to Clive Stafford Smith, the founder of Reprieve and Shaka Armour's lawyer for many, many years, and to put those to him and say, specifically, can you answer each of these?
Right.
And that was missing. I think what Charlie Savage missed with the Al-Qaeda allegations is that those were certainly made by unreliable witnesses in Guantanamo. And I know the kind of people that we're talking about, specific prisoners who made false allegations about a large number of their fellow prisoners. Without that, we don't really have anything. What we do have is that clearly within Guantanamo, Shaka Armour has been this inspirational character, demanding the rights of prisoners, encouraging his fellow prisoners to rise up, which was deeply alarming to the authorities. But I don't see that he did anything other than say to the Americans, you are not treating us the way that you are supposed to treat prisoners, and to say to his fellow prisoners, we cannot accept this. Now, you know, that's the context of how he was perceived within the prison. I'm really, I have to say, I'm genuinely quite shocked that it would be repeated without any questioning this notion that he had somehow encouraged people to commit suicide. Because I think that's a very grave allegation to lay at somebody's door and mm-hmm. to put out there without it being challenged.
Right. Also, I don't know that being charismatic has ever been found to be criminal, but that's certainly the implication here. Now, we also have a letter that was written by Senator Feinstein, who is the number two member of the Intelligence Committee, the former chair, unfortunately, my senator from California. And she was asking for assurances from the British that he would be carefully monitored and not permitted to reoffend in any manner. I find that pretty alarming that she would attempt to insert herself in that manner. But do you know if the British government has agreed to either continuing to detain him or to a rigorous monitoring program? Because the letter that Feinstein got back was a series of assurances that British authorities would be keeping a pretty short leash on Shaka when he returns to England.
Well, you know, Peter, they're clearly not going to give him a passport for some considerable amount of time. Give his Saudi passport back to him, you know, or allow him to travel. So, you know, in one very fundamental way, they will have him trapped in the UK for however long it takes until Shaka's lawyers are able to say to the British government, either, you know, you need to let this man travel, or what I hope will happen, you also need to convert his status into a British citizen. But he's not going anywhere. Now, you know, we have even more surveillance in this country than I think you have in the United States. You know, the British government spies on us all as remorselessly and relentlessly as it wishes, and they're undoubtedly going to do that to Shaka Amer. Are they going to spend a huge amount of money, you know, with people sitting in cars watching his every move? No, they're not. And they have always said that they were not prepared to spend a huge amount of money keeping individual former Guantanamo prisoners under 24/7 surveillance, which actually costs a lot of money in terms of hiring people to do the job. I would say they don't need that because you know, they monitor us so much through the use of our telephones, our credit cards, our computers, whatever. But also, you know, why should they think that Shaka Amer is a threat? This is a man who was approved for release on two occasions by high-level interagency review processes, which said, we are prepared to release this man because we do not think that he constitutes a significant threat to the United States. What happens with Guantanamo is that never, ever counts. And it's part of the problem with Guantanamo that people were never held in a way where guilt and innocence were established in normal ways. So people who have never been charged or convicted of anything get to be regarded as somehow more dangerous than people who have actually been convicted of a crime. And, you know, Senator Feinstein, unfortunately, is playing into that game by demanding something from the British, which they're not going to do. Only authoritarian regimes have treated former prisoners, you know, abusively. Most people, even from the early days, even countries that were very weak compared to the United States, were always told, you know, we want you preferably to put this person in prison. And if not, we want you preferably to put this person on trial. And if not, we want you to spend a lot of money keeping an eye on them. To which almost all governments turned around and said, you have got to be joking. The way that you have treated these people means that, you know, you have no right to say anything to us about how we should treat them. We have no reliable evidence against this person. Nothing. And that's the case with Shaka Amer. But, you know, it was the case with almost everybody else as well, Peter. And, you know, and it's a desperately weak argument. And people should be looking, as I say, at the fact that at the highest level, this man has been judged not to be a threat by the United States and should be allowed to get on with his life.
Now, Andy, one thing that we have to be considering is that Shaka Amer has been through hell and back and has been on hunger strikes at times. And clearly, given the torture, the psychological torture that has been implemented by the United States and the various types of games that they have played with prisoners at Guantanamo, we can't really be sure of his mental health. And I'm not trying to cast any aspersions or undermine, you know, what should be a great homecoming, but I think that people have to be prepared that this man may be a shadow of him his former self, and that he may require a great deal of care and therapy to recover from what the United States has done to him.
Well, absolutely, Peter. You know, and I have no idea. I mean, the amount of time is such a long time, you know? You know, Omar De Gaez, that I became friends with, who was held for 5.5 years, you know, compared to 13 years, it's quite a big difference. You know, I met former prisoners, and I have to say that, you know, a certain amount of counseling is available in our countries that isn't necessarily available to people who are released to poorer countries in the world, which I'm sure is of some help. You know, I also found amongst the prisoners, a deep desire for their religion to provide them with the kind of assistance that they need in readjusting. Also that there is a camaraderie amongst these people who are part of a, you know, horrible elite club of people who have been, you know, held without rights and tortured by the United States government. But, you know, that said, there are obviously going to be psychological issues. What I think I've seen over the years with prisoners, and I'm amazed that so many have been able, to survive, is that they had some positive outlook on life in the first place that sustained them, which, as I say, you know, is definitely partly attributable to their religion, to the camaraderie of their fellow prisoners. But also, you know, what you have inside yourself. And Shakarama clearly has something very strong inside himself. Mm-hmm. Roger Waters, I believe sympathizes with Shaka, that identifies with him as having the heart of a lion, which is how Roger puts it. So, you know, I would think that he will come through this, but I've no idea how you would deal with the long years of suffering that he's endured.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really do think there have been cases of people who, you know, were broken in a terrible manner by Guantanamo. And occasionally, you know, we've seen these people fall apart afterwards. You know, they're then blamed for things that happen as though the United States and the way they treated them had nothing to do with it, which I think is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. But I would say, you know, again, just to reiterate, what I've seen in so many cases is that I'm amazed by the resilience of people. And I would hope that Shaka has that kind of resilience. But I can only really just wish him the best, Peter. Yeah.
Well, and your point about resilience and also a lack of deep resentment.
Yeah.
I've talked to a handful of former Guantanamo prisoners, but to a man, they don't hold me as an American responsible. They hold American officials responsible, and they don't have the kind of deep-seated resentment that I believe I would have if I had been treated to even a year or two of what many of these men have endured for over 10 years. So,
well, you know what I think? What I think some of this is, Peter, is that, Allah has chosen for them this as a test. I mean, honestly, this is the way that a lot of the former prisoners have taken it, is that they're seeing this as something that God has chosen to put them through. And it's not for them to question why it was that they were put through it, which I think is where quite often a lot of Western commentators don't really see that. We don't really, we find it very hard to get beyond the personal of, like, you know, if we're not going to hold our immediate captors responsible for this, we're going to have this hostility towards the authorities. Whereas, you know, repeatedly I've spoken to former prisoners who have it's as though it's not in their hands, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So I think the hatred also is taken away. You know, they're not obsessing in a micro manner about, you know, the people who did this to them, which, you know, the comment that you must have heard so much over the years, people saying, well, if they weren't terrorists when they went in, you know, they would be when they came out, because that's the way people themselves are thinking about what this would have done to them. And it's like, well, no, you know. On two levels, that's wrong. A, these aren't, for the most part, the kind of people who are going to respond like that. But on the other hand as well, it's a flippant comment about terrorism. Terrorism involves murdering civilians for some purpose. This is not something that most people want to do with their lives. And, you know, mistreating somebody, even torturing people and treating them horribly the way that has happened at Guantanamo and in other places in the war on terror, isn't any automatic way of making someone cross a line where they would do that. I think very few human beings cross that line.
So, Andy, as we wrap up here, I'd just like to get your thoughts about the challenge that lies ahead and how you would like to see President Obama handle this. Because before we started recording, you and I were talking about how Ashton Carter went to Leavenworth, and then he went to the brig at Charleston and kind of put up trial balloons about moving Guantanamo prisoners there. And in both cases, there was a huge local backlash. And I believe that the president has to take true leadership on this and just say, we are transferring some of these guys to the Supermax prison in Marion, Illinois. Some are going to Colorado. Some are going to the brig. And some are going to Leavenworth. And that's that. Because he has failed to really assert himself. And at the same time, he allows the Justice Department to continue to appeal the release of the force-feeding tapes, to continue to appeal many of the credible cases for release that are brought up on habeas corpus, and to basically, you know, jam up the legal system at a time when they should be looking for ways to free it up in order to reduce the population and ultimately close the prison.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, they need to scrap the military commissions, so they need to have federal court trials for the handful of people that they can put on trial, who could then be moved into the appropriate prisons, having entered the federal court system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that any of the other prisoners should be considered for anything other than military detention, certainly not anything like a supermax, because you need to be part of the federal court system for that to happen. Either it's pre-trial or post-conviction. I think it needs to be the smallest number of prisoners possible. That's why, you know, I think moving the prisoners approved for release to any kind of facility on the U.S. mainland would be slightly more problematic. But I realize it's taking a long time to release these people because so many of them are Yemenis and countries have to be found. I think that there would be questions raised. It may be better. President Obama could come up with a plan that he could try and persuade McCain, in particular, as the head of the chair of the Armed Services Committee, to try and get Congress to approve. That would have some very dodgy language in it about not allowing these people to have the rights that U.S. citizens would have to challenge the basis of their detention, which I then think would be challenged in the courts. And I know that many of the lawyers and NGOs who are opposed to the existence of Guantanamo don't agree. I think the U.S. Constitution is so strong that there is no way that any of that would be allowed to stand, and that the challenges would take place about the right to indefinitely detain without charge or trial people on the U.S. mainland, foreign nationals, it turns out, but the very principle, of course, is unacceptable. I don't really see that it could have been significantly any more acceptable for it to have been taking place in Guantanamo. You know, a place that, although Cuba has ultimate sovereignty over it, is run by America and is essentially American. So there are all kinds of thorny issues. But is President Obama going to close the place before he leaves office, as he promised to do? If he is, then unless he can come up with a plan that he can work with McCain and other people to get through Congress, he's going to have to do something unilaterally by executive order, choosing a location, moving people, and then dealing with it. I wish that he would speed up the periodic review process, to be honest, Peter, because it's cleared 13 out of the 15 men who have had decisions taken in their cases. You know, these high-level review boards have said, we are prepared to allow these people to be released. Now, you know, on this basis, there are only going to be, at most, I would say, a few dozen people left against whom the government says it has any kind of case. And I think those would be the appropriate kind of figures, that we're looking at, say, a couple of dozen people being moved, and then still a fight going on for the establishment to demonstrate that even these people are people against whom they have some kind of objectively verifiable case. So we'll see. I'm sure we'll be talking again before the end of the Obama presidency, and it would be nice to think that, you know, by the start of whoever the next president is, by the start of their presidency, we will have reached somewhere where we're close to the end of this story. But I'm not going to hold my breath on that one.
And finally, Andy, I opened the podcast today with one of your songs from the Four Fathers, the song for Shaka Amer. And I understand that you are releasing a CD worth of songs available as downloads, and that 25% of the proceeds will go to Shaka's family. So
that's right.
Talk a little bit about the Four Fathers and tell us where we can go and pay to download your songs.
Well, it's on Bandcamp, and the band is called The Four Fathers. So I'm sure you'll find that and be able to put a link in with this podcast, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a band I set up with friends of mine here in London, and we play quite a lot of original material, and especially over the last year or so, I've been writing new songs. So I wrote a song for Shaka Amer, which we used in the campaign video for We Stand With Shaka. I've written another song which may interest some of your listeners, which is called $81 Million, which is about the architects of the Bush administration's torture program. And $81 million, of course, is the amount of money that two outside contractors were paid.
Mitchell and Jessen.
Mitchell and Jessen, for developing and implementing the post 9/11 U.S. torture program. What a huge amount of money for such a terrible, terrible undertaking.
Yeah.
You know, and there are other political songs. There are also love songs. It is available on CD, or it's available via downloads. People can download tracks individually, and yes, I'm giving 25% of the money from the song for Shaka Armour to Shaka's family, should they appreciate it. It's really going to be a token gesture unless people start queuing up in large numbers to buy them.
Well, let's make that a way that people can support your work and also express their support for the future of Shaka Armour. So yeah. I will put up the link to Bandcamp, and I invite listeners to go and sample the songs and buy some and support Andy's work, as well as Shaka Armour and his reunion with his family, which, as I said, should come, we hope, by the end of October. Always, Andy Worthington, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Peter. It's been great.
Shaka Armour, this one's for you, man. Happy trails. And a safe trip home from Guantanamo.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.